really enjoy the book of Ecclesiastes. I know I say this a lot, but it's one of my favorite books of the Bible, but I tend to say that just about for every book of the Bible. Ecclesiastes, in some ways, it lends itself to an overview study. The theme is very simple, and it's often repeated throughout the book, that this life is empty. It's not fulfilling in the ultimate sense. There are good things in this life, but as far as finding final, eternal, lasting fulfillment, it's not going to be found here. And we get to that conclusion many different ways from many different angles, and that leads us to the next conclusion, which is we need to look beyond the sun. We need to look for something higher, something farther. We need to look for God, and we need to fear God and plan for life beyond the sun. And so that's the theme, as we will see over and over again as we go throughout the book. And before we get into the book, I want to talk about some of the different introductory aspects that we've got listed in the handout. The first thing is the authorship. And we could spend a whole class just on who wrote the book. And you would kind of wonder, well, why would that be? As you read the book, you look at verse 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Okay? Well, how many kings were there that were the sons of David and kings in Jerusalem? Well, there was quite a few, right? There was the entire descendants of David all the way through the divided kingdom. But we also see in verse 12 that the preacher was king over Israel in Jerusalem. So this was somebody who was a king over the United Kingdom. So that narrows it down quite a bit. How many sons do we have of David that reigned in Jerusalem that were kings over the United Kingdom? One, Solomon. So that narrows it down quite a bit. So you look at that, and then you look at the description of himself as you go through the class, or as you go through the book, where he describes all of his wisdom, all of his possessions, all of his wealth, all the different things that he has. And he sets himself up as like no other king that came before him. So he's without equal. Again, who does that sound like? That sounds like Solomon. So it seems very obvious, if you take the text at face value, that the author would be Solomon. But what happened from about the time of Luther on, that there was people that began to question whether or not this was Solomon. They said, well, maybe this is somebody like after the captivity during the Persian rule that said, well, things are very tough, things are very difficult, life is very hard. I want to teach people about this, but I'm going to adopt the style, the authorship. I'm going to pretend I'm Solomon to kind of enhance my credibility. And so that has actually kind of caught on. And part of the reasons you will find this mentioned among members of the Lord's Church is Homer Haley took that position. And as you know, he had quite a large sphere of influence over a huge generation, over many different people. And so that's had a big influence over a lot of different people actually adopting this view. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this just because, as I said, we could take a whole class on it, but I think it's important for you to know of. Brother Walter makes several good arguments listing both sides, the pros and cons. And again, he accepts that Solomon, he takes the text at its face value, he accepts the fact that Solomon was the author. And I just have incredible difficulty even toying with the idea that some author could be posing as somebody else. I ask the question, why? Why would they be needing to do this? Well, somebody says it's to enhance the credibility. Well, where does the authors of the Bible, where does their credibility come from? It comes from inspiration. It comes from who was behind them. And since when has God needed to enhance his credibility? So that just doesn't make sense. And again, you're either left with this dilemma that either God is trying to deceive people by this person pretending to be someone who he's not, or he's not really deceiving. He is trying to say, I'm pretending to be this person, but really I'm not. So he's giving up his guise, if you will. He's not really deceiving people. So then what's the point? You're left in either way with this dilemma where you either have God deceiving people or God trying to do something that's without value or without merit. And so all of this just leads to nowhere, and so I just accept the text at its face value that Solomon was the author. A lot more we could say about this, and if you want to talk about it some more, that'll be fine. I'd be glad to do that outside the class. But since the focus of this class is looking at the book and getting an overview of the book, I don't want to spend any more time on this. Okay, so we've stated the theme as we're going through this book that this life is ultimately empty. There's many good things in this life, but if we're looking for final fulfillment, we're not going to find it here in this life. We're going to have to look beyond the life under the sun. Now, as you go through the text, I want to look at some of the key phrases that you see over and over again. The first one is this idea of under the sun. And he begins this very early, as we see this in the book. And what this refers to is this life. This is limited to, is contained by, it's bounded by the sun. In other words, this does not include God. This is not looking beyond the sun or something beyond this life. And then another word that you find over and over again is vanity. And this is the emptiness that's associated with this life under the sun and the various pursuits that when we follow those pursuits at the end, it's ultimately empty. There's some good, maybe some fulfillment, but as far as an eternal or lasting fulfillment, it's just not there. So another word we see very often as part of this question is what profit is it for man, and to what is the worthwhile life that he should lead under this sun that will bring him profit? In other words, how can he spend his life so that it will be worthwhile and bring profit to him? If all these things are empty and vain, then where is the profit? Where is the good that can come on life's investment? You'll see references to labor, and this often goes beyond the idea of just working your day job. This is your life, the work of your life, and you're always thinking, wrestling with different problems and different things in life. And so Solomon's, when he refers to labor, he's typically going beyond just our day-to-day work, but also the work of our entire life and trying to reconcile all of our different experiences and try to make sense of the things that we see around us. Another important term is this idea of evil, and I think it's important to mention because we know what evil is, right? That's wickedness. But you also find in this book that sometimes evil is used not in a moral sense, but in a... In this idea that it's undesirable. This is something that's not good, that it's not worked out the way that you want it to do. You've invested in a certain way, and then it goes south. It doesn't work out as you hoped or as you planned. And so that's often referred to as being evil itself. And then, of course, we find mentions of God several times as Solomon is ultimately bringing us to this conclusion that there is something beyond the sun. We need to look to that, and we need to prepare for that. And I'll mention also, there you'll see many times throughout the text that Solomon says, "I returned," or "then I turned and I saw this." And you get this idea as you're going through the text that you're actually kind of almost walking through Solomon's footsteps. You're seeing how he looked at things this way, and then he looked at things this way. And when I was first writing this, and as I've come up to this point before, I've always thought we were actually kind of following Solomon changing his mind, that I felt this way or thought this way, but then I learned something else, and so I changed my thinking. And I think you do see that in some cases, especially as we'll see this morning in chapter 2. But that's not always the case as you go through the book. Sometimes it's just the fact that he is looking at life, he's made some observations, and then he begins to think about it, and he's drawing some conclusions. And after thinking about it, making some lessons, then he returns back to his observations. And so it's a shift in focus of what he's looking at or thinking at the time. And these are key words to bring out because it helps us follow the text and make sure that we don't lose sight of it. The theme and the purpose, we've kind of talked about this in a little bit. You have a little bit more in the handout, so I won't go through this, assuming everybody's had a chance to look at this and read it and think about it. But one of the things I do want to mention is that for a lot of people, and I've heard this a lot, that people say, well, Ecclesiastes is such a cynical book. It's so pessimistic and it's so down. And some of that comes from the idea of the authorship that we were talking about earlier, that there's a lot of people who think that the book's not even inspired. And so it's just God has allowed this uninspired person to include their thoughts on life without God. Well, what kind of thoughts are people going to have on life without God? Well, it's going to be ultimately depressing and cynical. And so that comes from their view of the authorship. But In many ways, I liken this to the gospel itself. That there's good news and there's bad news. First, the bad news. If you don't know the bad news already, then it's going to be very shocking. It's going to be very overwhelming. And you're not going to be able to get past that to get to the good news. In the case of the gospel, the bad news is we're sinners. And we're condemned to hell. And if we don't already have some sense that our life, something's not quite right, and we're not already looking for some fix or for some salvation, something to make it right, then we're not going to be very excited about that news. In the same way, Ecclesiastes, it brings out the harsh realities of life. And if we're not already aware of that, if we've been closing our eyes saying, I don't see that, if we're living in denial, then it's going to seem like a very cynical and depressing book because it's trying to make us see something that we don't want to see. So we have to realize that's what's happening and have our eyes open to that. However, the book does have good news in that it's providing answers. It's providing resolutions to these problems, to these things that are difficult in life. All right. So just a few other points real quick, and we'll talk about the outline and get into the text. As you go through, I think most everybody is very familiar with especially the last few verses of Ecclesiastes. We know the conclusion, right? Fear God and keep His commandments. Let's hear the conclusion of the whole matter. This is the whole of man. We're very familiar with that. This conclusion, that's not the first place that it shows up in the text. It shows up multiple times in the text. So we find Solomon arriving to this conclusion, the same conclusion in many different ways throughout the text. So there is a sense in which this book may seem like it's a little bit repetitive or that it's going through the same points over and over again. But I think what's happening is the author is simply elaborating on this theme. If you think back to maybe raising your kids, and you try to teach them not to worry about what people say about you. Don't worry about that. It's what's important is what God thinks about you. And they say, okay, I got it. Well, do they really have it? No. It's not that easy. It's very easy to understand the words, but whether we don't quite believe it or we don't fully comprehend it or we haven't made full application, this lesson bears repeating over and over again until we get it. And it has to be elaborated on from many different angles to help us understand it and to accept it. And I think that's what's happening in Ecclesiastes is, as we said, the summary, the main point is very simple. We can say, I got it. But do we really get it? Is that what our life bears out? And I think the elaboration of this text helps us to make the changes necessary so that our life will bear that out. And Ecclesiastes is very difficult to outline. And there's again, two views of the text. You say, well, either this is a crazy, cynical person. He's just jumping around from one thing to another. And sometimes it seems like that as you go through the book. You have trouble establishing the verses. But Solomon, he's making an argument. He's making a case. You see too many words like therefore and moreover and furthermore. There's a progression. There's a line of thought to the book. And we know, again, there is a conclusion at the end of the book. This conclusion shows up again and again throughout the book. So if we begin with the assumption that Solomon is taking us, he's persuading us, he's taking us along this line of thought, then that brings upon us the burden of saying, okay, how do we connect the dots? How do we make a line through these different points that Solomon is making? And it reminds me of sitting in grade school in math class, and the teacher's giving you the example, and he's walking through the board, and you're having trouble following it. It's because he's skipping a few steps. He's assuming that you either know it or that you're going to be able to figure it out. And I think you see that with Solomon as well, that he's kind of skipping a few steps, and he's assuming that you'll put forth the energy, and you're going to think about it, and you're going to fill in the blanks, and you're going to connect the dots. So that's going to be one of the things that we're going to try to do as we go through the class. Now, as far as the outline itself, it can be broken down into four different discourses or sections, and each of these sections end with a conclusion of sorts, where Solomon says, for example, in Ecclesiastes 2:24, nothing is better for a man. So he's drawing a conclusion. He's considering all these things and saying, okay, here is a conclusion. You can't do any better than this, or this is the way you should look at things. And at the end of each of these sections, you'll see a conclusion of sorts where, again, Solomon has come around and come back to this main point. So We have the four sections here. I'll again mention Bob has a really good, I think, write-up and summary of Ecclesiastes in his book, and he has this four discourse outline. And then Bob also mentions this book, Ecclesiastes Total Life, and it's a good little commentary, a lot like the other one that we talked about earlier. Small pages, big print, very easy to read, and it gives you a very good overview. It's called Ecclesiastes Total Life, and it's by Walter C. Kaiser Jr., and I would highly recommend it. It seems to have a good sense of the big picture of Ecclesiastes and tying everything together. Okay, with that introduction out of the way, let's get into the discourses themselves. And the way that I've chosen to go through it is, at first I thought, well, we'll pick out key passages that are kind of exemplary, kind of like we did in Psalms and like Scott did in Proverbs. But the problem that I found is everything's so connected that I can't figure out which parts to pull out and say this is representative. So what we're going to do is we're going to kind of just skim it. We're going to read a few verses and then we'll try to paraphrase some of the other ones and bring up some of the high points as we go through the text. So the first thing we're going to see is that Solomon identifies himself in verse 1. And what we'll do is we'll read verses 2 through 11. Because I think this is important for setting up the main part of the book, or the theme of the book. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been done is what will be. That which is done, let me read that again. That which has been is what will be, and that which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of the things that are to come by those who will come after. So is Solomon setting up, is he being cynical here, saying it's just empty, it's just vanity? What's the context? You look at verse 3, what profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? That's one of our key phrases again, where he's setting up this context of, as you said, as creation or life, just what we can see. And we're limited and bounded by, ultimately by the sun as far as we can see in a figurative sense. Now, when he describes the water and the winds, what are they doing? They're going round and round, and where are they going to? Nowhere. They're not getting anywhere. But what's happening to man? He comes and he goes. So you wonder, what is the point of all these things? These things, the earth, the water, the winds, all this stuff is going round and round and not getting anywhere. And so it's not making any progress. What about man? Well, he's just transitory. He's coming and he's going. So what is the point of his being here? And so he's setting up the question of the questions of life and trying to understand those. Mike? Right. Yeah. A very good point. So he brings these things up and he helps, as you said, grab our attention. He makes us realize that we're not here very long and that from this world's perspective, we're not that important. We're going to be gone a little while and nobody's going to remember us. Nobody's going to even know who we are. So we're just passing through. So it's very sobering. He's grabbing our attention. And what about this statement? I think we've got this question number one where he says there's nothing new under the sun. What's the point of that observation as we tie that in to our theme and main point thus far? Why is that significant? Mm-hmm.
Talking about life process, generation. Nothing new that breaks this cycle.
Mm-hmm.
God put it in motion.
So So we've seen all these changes in technology, I mean, computers and the automobiles, airplanes, so much is, you know, nuclear power, so much has changed from a technology standpoint. But as far as the problems of life, what has really changed? Nothing. We're still born, we still die, we still have problems with jealousy, with pride, we still have love, we still have all these different things. The human condition has not really changed. It may be, you know, a few differences on the outside, but the fundamental problems, they all are still the same. Whether it's people chasing after a new TV or if it's people chasing after a new oxen, it's still the same thing. It's still the same heart and the same problems that men face, and they must wrestle with the same things. All right. Now, I think another reason why he's bringing this up is this also, you know, as you think of any persuasive work where someone's trying to persuade somebody, there's going to be somebody that's bucking against that conclusion who doesn't want that. Or what are young people going to say? Well, that was so long ago. So much has changed. This doesn't apply anymore. No, it still applies. Nothing has really changed. Some of the trappings, some of the colors, the outsides, things, the glitter and the charm may have changed, but underneath it's all the exact same. So that's not a good excuse for us to buck his conclusion here. All right, so in verses 12 through 14, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. I've seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. So why is it that man is unsatisfied? Why is he seeking this fulfillment? I mean, this is kind of strange if you think about it. You don't see dogs and cats walking around going, you know, what am I missing? There's something I'm missing here. You know, seeking for fulfillment in life. Why is man this way?
All of the man is very empty if we like
him. Mm-hmm.
We look at the...
So for the animal, that does satisfy them, right? Their food, their sleep, all those things, that's satisfying. But for man, there's something more. He's made in the image of God. And as we see, as we'll get into chapter 3, that God is, he says he set eternity in our heart. So there's something missing that in man's heart, something he needs, something that has to be supplied. And until that's supplied, he's going to keep looking. He's going to keep trying to fill in this hole and trying to make things right. Here he describes it as something being crooked that cannot be made straight. So there's, and I think this refers to, as we'll see later, the different inequalities, that the problems that we, as we look at life, there's things that are not quite right. And they're unsettling to us. They bother us. That why is it that there's a good man and he suffers? He may die very young, and then yet here's somebody who's very wicked and they live on and they prosper and they're wealthy. There's something in every man that says that's not quite right. And that's bothersome. And this is the task that God has intended for us to observe that and to think about it and to wrestle with it. And what he says here is that what is crooked cannot be made straight and what is lacking cannot be numbered. So we are struggling with a problem that we cannot solve and that we cannot fix. But yet we're going to have to come to terms with it in some way. All right. So ultimately this is a God-given task that is brought to man. So as we look at the next part, I'm going to skip over some of these verses. I'll read verse 7 and 18, where Solomon says, I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I perceive that this also is grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So I want to touch on one thing real quick. So obviously, wisdom is better, but yet here he's saying that wisdom leads to grief, leads to sorrow. What kind of wisdom is he talking about? In earthly wisdom, right?
You know,
right, right. You think about 1 Corinthians 2:6, where Paul talks about coming to them in the wisdom of men. That's not the way that he came and he preached to them and spoke to them. We have that throughout Scripture where there is different sources of wisdom. And he's talking about the wisdom that you can gain in this life under the sun that's limited by that. And what he's saying here is that the more you increase, the more you learn, the more you see, the more you realize you don't know, and there are these problems that are out there, and the more you learn about them, and the more bothersome they become. Uh-huh.
I so serve the Father and let my goal gain as much wisdom as I can be, or to gain wealth. Wisdom in every one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Wisdom in this world, powerful.
Mm-hmm.
More materially powerful, financial, and so on. And every one of those really have to come back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's where it's real.
That's true. Okay. So Solomon is, I think you see this a little bit in verse 16, that he's beginning to set himself up as someone who's uniquely qualified for this task of trying to resolve these different things, where he's talking about the fact that he's gained more wisdom than those that have come before him. And now he's going to use this and apply this to this task, this burdensome task that's given to men. And so as we go through chapter 2, we see him looking for every imaginable and taking every imaginable path to find happiness, to find fulfillment. If it's looking for pleasure, well, he takes that, and at the end of that, he finds vanity. He says, okay, well, I'm going to just laugh and make myself happy that way, but that leads to madness, and it's just crazy. And of mirth, what's the point? What does it accomplish? So then he seeks how to satisfy himself, his flesh, he says specifically, through wine, but yet he's not doing this in a reckless or crazy way, that he's still using wisdom. And he seeks out all these different things. He builds all of these great things. So he busies himself with incredible projects and tasks. And, you know, thinking back to our narrative, we can think of many of those. The gardens, the orchards. He has all these different water pools and trees and servants, males and females. Seeing them come and go, born into his own house. Great flocks, cattle, silver, gold, men and women singers, all kinds of musical instruments. And I think some of the translations may actually translate that as concubines. So he says that he was great and he excelled in all of these different ways. He had all these things more than anybody that had gone before him. And yet, amazingly, his wisdom stayed with him. And so that allowed him to continue to analyze and look over these things and draw conclusions on it, even though he had deliberately taken paths that would lead nowhere. So why is it relevant that Solomon, specifically Solomon, has exhausted all these earthbound avenues for fulfillment and found nothing? Mm-hmm. I go back to the idea, you think in it's the last chapter where he's clearly speaking to a youth. And I think that we see in some ways, I think that's in some ways the ideal audience as we look at this book and mindset to put ourselves in, is how would the youth respond to all of this? Well, as we talked about earlier, maybe there's something new. That's old, that doesn't apply anymore. And well, we could say, well, Solomon may have done those things, but I got these things that I'm going to try. What are you going to try that Solomon didn't try? I mean, he had everything imaginable. There is nothing that you can do that Solomon cannot do. That's a good point. Right. And he was right. But all these things that he had told me not to amass and whatnot, that it didn't gain him anything when he went on that. I think he makes this point in verse 12. Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. And I think that's one of the important things of realizing about Solomon being the one here that's speaking to us, is there is no possible way to improve on his pursuits that he's done here. There's nothing we can do and reach out for that he didn't already grasp and have in abundance.
What can a man do to sustain the king and do the prep work for next quarter? He will not one side now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Good point. So we see this this benefit that he recognizes. There's a benefit of wisdom over folly. He says in verse 13, "Then I saw that wisdom excels folly, as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then the more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity. For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. How does a wise man die? As the fool. Therefore I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me. For all is vanity and grasping for the wind. So I think, as you see, as we continue these verses, this is one of the turns that I was talking about earlier. That if you back up at the beginning of chapter 2, he's looking for all these things that'll find pleasure. And he says in verse 10, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. For my heart rejoiced in all my labor. This was my reward from all my labor. So he did have some temporary joy that came with all these projects and acquiring all these things and enjoying them and consuming them as best as he could. But yet when he gets past that, and you know, the day after Christmas has come and gone, and all the toys have been opened and played with for a while, all of a sudden the newness wears off and things aren't as fun as they used to be, and he becomes bored with them, and they're ultimately not satisfying to him. And then at this point we have this kind of aftershock, if you will, where we see him, he's despairing, he's hating life. What's the point? Why am I doing this? What is the value here? So I think this is where we see Solomon kind of turning one of these corners. And I think this is helpful. This is interesting. If you think about Paul when writing Romans, he anticipates. He's very, again, a very logical book. And he says, well, I'll say this, but you will say to me this, this, and this. And then he proceeds to answer. He's anticipating this argument. Solomon is doing the same thing. He's anticipating these arguments. But instead of saying, well, you will say to me, he's saying, well, this is how I reacted. He's saying, I've been there. This is the way I thought. This is the way I looked at it. And so he's anticipating the arguments by actually just going through his life, showing you how he used to think these very things himself at one point. So we see him despairing of these things of life. And again, the point is, if you try to find pleasure, try to find fulfillment in this life, you can find something temporary, but is it lasting? Is it eternal? Is it something to build a life on? Is it profitable? Is it worthwhile? No, not ultimately, not finally. And so, but there is some happiness to be had there. So he puts this peg down, this stake, if you will. He makes this one conclusion. And I'll start in verse 22. For what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity. Nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. But to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is of good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for wind. So God enables the person who is good, who is right in his eyes, he enables them to have enjoyment in this life. And where does it come from? From very rich, very wealthy things. Do you have to work incredibly hard to get that? No. Very simple things. From food, from drink, from work, from sleep. These simple things bring some of life's greatest pleasures. And this is something that God enables us to do. And then he also provides them wisdom and knowledge to enjoy these things. But to those who are not approved in his sight, what are they doing? Do they have happiness? Do they have pleasure? Do they have fulfillment? Not, again, they may have this temporary, this transitory, you know, enjoyment of these new things, but do they have that lasting one? Do they have that when they lay their heads down at night and they're at peace? No, they don't have that. Instead, they're just driven, constantly trying to gather more and more stuff, like a person who's mad, just trying to find some answer where it cannot be found. And so, so this is the conclusion he makes at this point. But again, he says, this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. So we have to keep in mind that this is not, even though God gives us this joy for a while, it is just for a while. We cannot depend on it and say, well, that's what I'm going to make my life around. This is just one part or one good thing that we have in this life, but it's not the sum of it. So he keeps going. So now we begin the second discourse, which goes from Ecclesiastes 3:1 through 5:20. And what we're going to see here as we go through chapter 3 through about the middle part, he's really in some ways getting to his conclusion. He's getting to some of his main points. And then from about verse 16 in chapter 3 on till the near the end of the book, he's really beginning to anticipate objections and begin to answer some of those. So let's read a little bit about chapter 3, and then we will pick up with some of the important points next time. But we'll go ahead and read this so we can be thinking about it. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down, a time to build up. So he's mentioning all these different times that we have in life. And then he asks this question, what profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. So as you go through the different times here, listed in verses 2 through 8, one of the questions that comes to mind is whose time is this? And what I think we see is these are the different times that happen in this life. If you look around you, you see all of these different things that are happening, that are going on around you. And we see that in verse 11, that it's God who's in control of these things. He has made everything beautiful in its time. There is some design, there is some arrangement, there is some planning, there is providence at work in each of these things happening. There is something going on with the arranging of all these different things that we see in life. And so that's one of the first conclusions that he's setting up, is that God is in control of these different things. He has made everything beautiful in its time. So there is an arrangement, there is some order. And the question that we're going to have is, well, what in the world is that order? What is that plan? What is happening? Not in a generic, not in a big picture view, although that may be part of it, but maybe in my life. Where are things going? How are things leading? How do I interpret these different things? And we see that this is something, you know, part of the question that we have. We look in verse 11. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. So what we have is something that's kind of surprising. And in a way, it seems in itself not quite right. Kind of almost ironic or cruel in some ways, but it leads somewhere. That God has made us, he's put a need or a hunger in us, and then he's put us in an environment where there's no possible way that can be fulfilled. Why in the world did he do that? Well, is he a cruel or is he a capricious God? Not by a long shot. There's some reason why he's done that. And that's what I want us to think about and pick up with next time. Why has God done things the way he has? Thank you for your time and attention.